From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Sam Phillips. She used to be known as Leslie Phillips when she was a star of the Christian music world. Also today, actor Rip Torn. He co-stars with Gary Shandling on The Larry Sanders Show. He plays the producer of the late-night talk show. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of opera overtures played on wind instruments. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has asked PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to return to peace talks. The PLO left the negotiations after a Jewish settler shot several Arab worshippers to death in a West Bank mosque. Rabin says Israelis suffer terror attacks too and are still willing to talk.
Not a week passes that we don't have to bury our dead. And if only for this reason, we don't think it appropriate to raise new demands after every terrorist attack. Security is a two-way street.
President Clinton agrees with Mr. Rabin. He says the United States will make every effort to assist both parties to achieve a lasting peace.
Today we discussed ways to put the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations back on track. We agreed on the need for concrete measures to ensure security for Palestinians as well as for Israelis, and for rapid implementation of the Declaration of Principles to give Palestinians control over their own affairs and well-being.
Congressman Dan Rostenkowski says he's surprised by his big win in yesterday's Illinois primary election. He defeated four challengers and garnered 50% of the vote. He's also favored to win the general election. There have been questions about his campaign and congressional finances. Rostenkowski chairs the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. He thanked President Clinton for campaigning for him and helping him win. Now he's pledging to help the president to get his legislative agenda through Congress. Negotiators for the United Auto Workers and General Motors are at the bargaining table trying to end a strike at two plants in Dayton, Ohio. The strike has also idled workers at assembly plants in Lansing, Michigan. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
The strike, which started Monday, is beginning to affect other General Motors plants across the country. This morning, first shift workers at a GM truck and bus plant outside Fort Wayne, Indiana, were forced to leave after running out of parts because of the strike. Second shift workers were told not to report. A GM spokesman says work at the facility will not resume until more parts are available. The Saturn assembly plant in Tennessee is also in danger of closing, idling 8,500 workers. About 3,000 GM employees walked off the job in Dayton Monday after talks failed to renew a three-year contract. Workers say negotiations broke down over job security issues and subcontracting work at GM plants. The two Dayton facilities make anti-lock brakes and master cylinders, which supply most assembly plants. The company has a limited supply of parts on hand at each plant. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan reporting.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 14 points at 3,864. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq has risen 5.5 points to 799. This is NPR. The government is reporting a 0.3% gain in inflation at the consumer level. The rise in the consumer price index is the biggest in 3 months, and it's about what analysts had expected. The Labor Department says the gain is mostly due to increased energy prices. It's been a very cold winter, and many consumers have kept the thermostat turned up to ward off the cold. Volatile food prices actually fell 0.3%. Meanwhile, construction of new homes has increased. The Commerce Department says housing starts were up just over 4% in February. China's foreign minister says he's disappointed with Secretary of State Warren Christopher's recent visit to Beijing, but China is blaming Washington for the failure of progress in talks on human rights. The BBC's James Miles reports.
At a news conference in Beijing, the Chinese Foreign Minister Chen Qichun said that, like President Clinton, who's expressed his disappointment over Warren Christopher's recent visit to Beijing, he too was somewhat disappointed. The foreign minister said something happened just before Mr. Christopher's trip, which showed the Americans were insincere in their approach to the visit. Mr. Chen was alluding to a meeting in Beijing between a senior American official and the country's most famous dissident, Wei Jingsheng. Mr. Chen said there'd been no narrowing of differences between the two sides in their views on human rights. It's widely expected, however, that China might release a few well-known political prisoners in the next few weeks in an effort to convince Washington not to withdraw Beijing's most favored nation trading status.
James Miles reporting. The World Bank is criticizing African nations for their inability to get out of economic stagnation. A report blames African governments for half-hearted policy decisions. The report's authors are calling for African governments to seriously apply macroeconomic principles to their policies, like liberalizing trading policies. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer-songwriter Sam Phillips started her career recording Christian music under her birth name, Leslie Phillips. She was so popular, she was nicknamed the Queen of Christian Rock. But in spite of her success, she became disenchanted with the Christian music industry and left to make her first secular record in 1988. Her new record, Martinis and Bikinis, is her third secular release. It's on Virgin Records. Like her previous three records, it was produced by singer-songwriter T-Bone Burnett, who is now her husband. In Entertainment Weekly, Sam Phillips' music was called pop at its most inventive. In the New York Times, her music was described as proof enough that the secular and spiritual can intersect in strange, affecting ways. Before we hear the song Baby, I Can't Please You from her new album, let's hear what Sam Phillips has to say about writing it.
Baby, I Can't Please You sounds like it's between a man and a woman, but it's really more about fundamentalism, and not any particular fundamentalism, but it could be Muslim or Christian or New Age. It's just that human tendency we have to make rules out of faith and to organize love, what I think it does, it's very unhealthy because it usually pigeonholes people and gets very legalistic and very small-minded, and so that's what that's about. Although there is a sort of a smile in there with all the Indian kind of instruments, because in some of those cultures, women are very, they have to please men or they'll get their heads cut off or something horrible like that. So
you take the words I say and make them mean everything they don't.
Phillips, how do you think your songwriting has changed since you left Christian music?
The one thing I believe about songs and about art in general, I guess I should say, is that I think it should inspire. I don't really think the place of a song or a painting, I don't think it should teach. I don't think it should be propaganda. I think that's too heavy. That weighs down the song or the picture. And I try to do that in my music. I don't think it should be useful, or art shouldn't be utilitarian.
And when you were recording Christian music, did it have that burden of teaching in the lyrics?
The audience certainly demanded that, and they wanted to be told what they believed over and over again for fear that they might not believe it any longer. It was a very, very odd place to be in. But yes, basically, I think they wanted propaganda, and I couldn't live with that. So I quit and started completely from scratch.
In some of the Christian music I've heard, this song sounds like a love song, and it sounds like a love song being sung to a lover, but in the chorus you realize that the love is addressed to Jesus.
Yeah, it's sort of dishonest, isn't it?
Is that?
I think, you know, the whole thing, I think, is very, there's a very, very thin veneer of spirituality over a very thick slab of show business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I prefer just seeing the show business without the slimy spiritual veneer.
When you were writing Christian lyrics, were there certain subjects that you felt were off limits to you, like writing about certain fears or doubts?
No, I was pretty honest, I think just ignorantly so, because I had grown up in California, and I think there was an underground parachurch movement, you know, outside of the organized church. And I've always felt most comfortable in organization or outside of organizations, being a part of the anti-movement underground, I guess you'd say. So I didn't really know about the Bible Belt or the demands of gospel music when I first started writing, because I just wanted a place to be able to write about spiritual things and explore different spiritual directions, you know, in music.
But you did very well on the Christian music circuit, right? I mean, you sold really well. You were very popular.
Well, I was making money, which is a lot for a lot of musicians to say, I guess. But it wasn't worth it to me. You know, in good conscience, I wanted to explore different areas, and I couldn't do so, making records for that company. So I quit and started over again.
So what was the last straw for you? What made you decide, okay, I'm going to get out?
I don't know. It's such a long story. There's so many things. I think I was just starting to go off in different directions, and they just couldn't. When I first met T-Bone Burnett, who's my husband and also produces my records, he and I made one record together called The Turning, where I aired my grievances. And actually, everything took care of itself, because I think people thought after that record I was probably a heretic and didn't really want to have anything more to do with me. And I also said, I quit. So I'm not going to do this anymore. And I didn't really know if I was going to do music at all anymore.
Well, why don't we hear the title track from the album, The Turning? Does this song do what you were talking about having lyrics that really surprised and maybe alienated your Christian music fans?
I think so, because it admits that one is human. You know, it's saying that basically when life really hits me hard, I don't want to become bitter. And I think a lot of those people believe that life won't hit them hard because they're God's chosen people or something, you know, something really pretentious and judgmental like that.
From light to shadow, from burning to indifference, a turning of heart to granite. Steel ropes to molten fear. Oh, and when it turns on me, don't let it turn me. And when it turns on me, don't let it turn me. And when it turns on me, don't let it turn me. And when it turns on me, don't.
You said when you left Christian music, you weren't sure that you were going to stay in music at all after that. Why did you doubt staying in music?
Well, I will always write songs. I mean, till the day I die, probably. I mean, that's what I started doing when I was 14 and what I will always do. But whether to put them out and to have a record company and go through the all the hoops you have to go through to promote the record and to get it out there, I think I was seriously looking at that, whether I wanted to do that anymore.
And what made you decide to stay?
In the music? Songs. and also being able to connect with people when I sing live, when I sing to them. That's very important to me.
Mm-hmm. When you started recording secular music, were you worried about finding a new constituency, you know, finding new fans, starting all over again?
Well, it's an interesting thing to do. It's a very weird thing to do after you've done a lot of work and you have an audience to suddenly have no audience. But it was a wonderful experience as well, because it was pushing off into a, you know, uncharted waters, and a new territory. It was great fun, actually.
Did you not want your new fans to know much about your Christian music past? Did you feel that they would judge you by that?
Yes, simply because of all the things I have against. In the media, I think we've all seen the abuse of Christian fundamentalism. We've all felt the blows of it, you know, these people wanting money, just all the terrible hypocrisy, and I was afraid that people would confuse me with televangelists or something, you know, and because of my past. But really, I'm just, you know, I've always been after the truth, the attractive truth, and also the ugly truth as well.
In the first song that we heard, "Baby, I Can't Please You," you described that as your reaction against fundamentalism. Were you ever a part of the kind of fundamentalism that you're reacting against?
When I was very young, yeah, because I came from a very, my parents were broken when I got them. You know, they didn't work right, exactly, and that made life difficult. And so, trying to figure life out, I had a little more figuring maybe than the normal person to do. And fundamentalism gives you very quick and easy answers. It's also very disposable ones, which I have disposed of, I guess.
Do you feel in your own way that you're still singing about spirituality, but in a different kind of language?
I think, you know, it's pretty hard to divorce what I think about most in life, or what I'm interested in from my writing. So I'm sure that it's, you know, that colors the way I look at things, and it colors what I do. But I don't want to try to put any propaganda into my music. I just try to write songs and let them be what they are, not trying to convince anybody of anything or teach anybody anything. I just, hopefully, the ultimate for me would be to be able to inspire people.
Singer-songwriter Sam Phillips is my guest. She has a new album called Martinis and Bikinis. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer-songwriter Sam Phillips. And let me ask you about your name. Your birth name is Leslie Phillips, and that's the name you recorded under in Christian music. Your recent albums are under the name Sam Phillips, which I believe is a nickname you've had for a long
Sam
time.
Sam is a nickname, yeah. And I'd had that for quite a while, and when I met T-Bone, he said, "Well, you know who the other Sam Phillips is, don't you?" And I said, "No." And he proceeded to tell me that, you know, Sam Phillips had discovered Elvis Presley and Sun Records and all that.
So how did you get the nickname Sam?
You know, I don't even remember. As I said, you know, my family, they were always coming up with nicknames for everyone.
So it was just a family nickname from when you were a kid?
Yes.
Now, you grew up in Hollywood, right?
Actually, I was born in East Hollywood and grew up in Glendale and also Joshua Tree. We had a cabin out there that we spent a lot of time at.
I think your parents were originally from Texas. What brought them to California?
My father was from Texas. My grandfather was from Oklahoma. My dad had very bad experiences in Texas as a little boy. A lot of racial prejudice that scared him. A lot of bad experiences. So I never heard about Texas when I was growing up. I never heard country music, and just discovered it, you know, more as an adult. I really love country music, traditional country music. And in fact, T-Bone and I are starting a country band. We've done some recording and writing for it, and I'm anxious to get back to that because my great-great-grandfather was a minstrel on the Chautauqua circuit and sang and played. So maybe that's where it comes from.
Don't you wish you could hear what he sounded like?
Absolutely. I'm trying to track him down. I'm trying to trace him through that. I guess it was kind of like a Wild West vaudeville show outdoors. This is as near as I can figure it.
Like a medicine show or something?
Yeah, something like that. So I'm anxious to find out more about him and what he did.
So how old were you when you started to sing and write songs?
I was 14.
And what got you started?
It was more of a cathartic thing for me. I could put the things I was struggling with, the pain or my fears or my feelings, into a song, and it seemed to make it that much easier to deal with, because it kind of, you put it into some kind of a concrete, or maybe not so concrete, but put it into some, organized into some kind of a form you could look, stand away from it and look at.
Which came first for you, songwriting or singing?
Oh, songwriting. Yeah, I'm just still learning how to sing, really. And I did a tour last year with Bruce Coburn. I was on the road for about 6 months with him, and I just took a guitar out and sang the songs to the audience with just a guitar. And I learned a lot about the songs and also about singing. I learned how to connect with a deeper place physically and emotionally, and really started learning about singing quite a bit. I don't know if anyone else could tell, but it's a lot more interesting for me at this point, because I've never really considered myself a singer.
As you were mentioning before, your husband, T-Bone Burnett, also produces your records. And I wonder what it's like to work together. Do you enjoy working with somebody that you're that close with?
Well, I think that the working together is very natural for us. That's the way we became friends, mm-hmm. making records. And so that's a lot of fun and easy. I think it's always the little thing, the domestic life that's, you know, more difficult. You know, who's going to get the last piece of cake? And
who's doing the dishes?
Right.
Who's vacuuming?
All that stuff.
Right. The production on the new album, for instance, is really strong. And I think, a lot of the arrangement sounds, a lot of the electronics and percussion and so on comes from T-Bone Burnett. Is that a style that you feel comfortable with? And does he sometimes try things out on your records, experiment with things on your records?
Well, we all experiment, and there are, sometimes I have ideas for guitar parts that he'll be very kind to play, and then he has his take. Basically, it's we try to cast the record, with the musicians, and let them do what they do. There's nothing worse than bringing in the wrong kind of musician and trying to make them play against what they would do naturally. So we try to cast them in like characters in a play and let them go. They're very involved in the arrangements as well. But Black Sky would be one song that we actually did do an experiment with. Chad Blake, the engineer, took that one and completely rearranged it through the mix. And he did a really strange thing. He took a binaural head, which is a microphone that has basically two ears. It's like a human, hears the way a human head would hear. And he put that in the middle of a room, and then he put, the guitar coming through a speaker in a trash can on one side. He put the accordion coming through a 1940s PA system coming on another side, and just put, did a mix that way through this binaural head, which is not very typical, very unusual.
Why don't we hear that?
The commerce, the intrigue, self-slaughtered souls cry out to dead poor men for a drink at the water hole. Tongues will burn dry as the day they were sold for forests raped into desert. We won't stop till we're underneath the black sky. La 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 la.
You and your husband, T-Bone Burnett, are both songwriters. When you're working together, do you have to almost protect your songs against his urge to rewrite them or something? Or does he have to protect his songs against your urge to rewrite them?
I have to slap his hand. Yes. No, actually, surprisingly, because he has a very strong personality and a wonderful songwriter, he has enough of a... enough confidence that he doesn't have to go in and rewrite my song. He's a wonderful editor, basically, is how we work. So but he really lets me make the decisions for my record and my songs. He's very respectful.
Do you waver back and forth between wanting to show him a song right away?
Yes.
And not wanting to show him because you don't want him to change it. You don't want his suggestions. What you want to hear is, this is great. Just
yes.
Leave it alone.
Oh, always. Absolutely. Yes. I try not to play it for him before it's finished, definitely, because he's so opinionated and so tough on me. Such a tough critic. But you know the good thing about T-Bone is he's very tall and he can get into those very high cupboards that I can't. So that's why I married him, I think.
Do you think it's good to have a tough editor around, or do you think it's inhibiting?
Absolutely. No, I think it's really good because he has very high standards that I think most people, and as a producer, I think he does as well. Most people don't care about, aren't as meticulous about the things that he cares about, or... people don't think about lyrics in terms of Bob Dylan, you know, which I think is a very, very high standard.
Mm-hmm. If we were making, say, a movie about your lives, there'd be plenty of scenes probably where you're sitting around the living room just, playing and singing together. Are there plenty of scenes like that in real life, or does that all get saved for work?
Oh, no, they're wonderful. Actually, and it would probably be him sitting and playing and me listening. Those are the scenes, I think, because he has a wonderful memory. He knows so many old songs, folk songs and blues songs, and seems to pull them out of the hat from nowhere. I mean, songs from 20 years ago he can remember.
And you can't?
No. I don't have a good memory for that, no.
What were the songs you loved when you were growing up?
Oh, I loved a lot of the really old songs, Gershwin and Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein, and I love Stefan Grappelli and Django Reinhardt. That to me is music you can put on always. Some of their early recordings, the Paris recordings, and you can always feel good.
Now, do you hear yourself ever singing Gershwin or Rodgers and Hart?
I would love to. I would love to do that at some point. I love being a torch singer.
What's holding you back?
Actually, I do a little bit of that live. I've done that. I don't know if I'd want to make a whole record of that, but but maybe someday with the right musicians, I would love to. Actually, I think I would probably love to work with Van Dyke Parks on something like that. He's a wonderful arranger and songwriter.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Sam Phillips' new album, Martinis and Bikinis, is on Virgin Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more from Sam Phillips' new CD.
I left my conscience like a crying child. Locked the doors behind me, put the pain on fire. Broken like a window, I assume my blindness now. And I need love, not some sentimental prison. I need God, not the political church. I need fire to melt the frozen sea inside me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Casting directors used to tell Rip Torn that his name was too funny to be taken seriously. Coming up, we find out how he got that name. He now co-stars with Gary Shandling on The Larry Sanders Show. He plays the producer of the late-night talk show. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Overture, a new recording by the Harmonie Ensemble of New York, conducted by Steve Richman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has concluded a visit to Washington. He's calling on the Palestine Liberation Organization to return to peace negotiations. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
Both Mr. Clinton and Prime Minister Rabin called for resumption of talks on implementing the Israel-PLO peace agreement. And Rabin again brushed aside Palestinian security concerns raised after last month's massacre in a West Bank mosque.
We don't think it appropriate to raise new demands after every terrorist attack. Security is a two-way street.
Rabin's statement came the day after an Israeli human rights group reported that Israeli security forces had killed over 1,000 Palestinians since 1988, while Palestinians had killed about 180 Israelis. Bill Small at the White House.
Leading Democrats are divided over the prospect of congressional hearings into the Whitewater affair. Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski says he is not enthusiastic about the idea, especially since a special counsel is conducting a separate investigation. But Rostenkowski says he thinks hearings into the matter are inevitable. House Speaker Tom Foley won't hear of it. Several Democratic members of the Senate Budget Committee met with President Clinton at the White House this morning. Several are urging Republicans to hold off on hearings and allow the special counsel to conduct his business. Senator James Sasser, who attended the meeting, says congressional hearings just wouldn't help matters.
I have no objection to an unbiased hearing of this whole matter. But I fear that many want to use this to make it into some kind of political circus, and I think that might be the ultimate result.
A Supreme Court justice has turned down an emergency appeal from a group that wants to ban gays and lesbians from marching in Boston's St. Patrick's Day parade. Justice David Souter rejected the request, and the veterans group that sponsors the parade has said it'll cancel the event if Souter refused to exclude the homosexual groups. The highest court in Massachusetts had ruled that parades are public events and cannot discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Weapons inspectors say North Korean officials wouldn't let them visit a key nuclear processing plant during their recent visit. The site is a radiochemical lab that's believed to be capable of producing plutonium. That's a key component of nuclear weapons. An official with the International Atomic Energy Agency says the inspection team was barred from taking samples at the facility. He's suggesting that there was other trouble, too. The inspection was supposed to be part of an agreement between the United States and North Korea to improve relations. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 1.5 points to end the day at 3,848. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. Michigan voters have chosen to pay increased sales taxes instead of more income tax to help finance state schools. Citizens voted yesterday to replace local property taxes with a 2-cent hike in the sales tax. Don Gagne reports.
Michigan voters gave overwhelming approval to a proposal that increases the sales tax from its current 4 cents on the dollar up to 6 cents. The proposal also includes a 50-cent per pack hike in cigarette taxes. Had Proposal A been defeated, an income tax would have gone into effect by default. Governor John Engler called the vote great news for education reform efforts in the state.
It's a victory for the school children. It's a victory for taxpayers. It's a victory for homeowners. And most of all, it's a victory for Michigan.
Several other states considering school finance reforms of their own may follow Michigan's lead in the year ahead. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne reporting.
A political opponent of Russian President Boris Yeltsin is calling for the restoration of the Soviet Union. Former Vice President Alexander Rutskoy, a leader of last year's parliamentary rebellion, has faxed his message to several organizations. He's calling the dissolution of the former USSR irresponsible and light-minded. He's been released from prison because of an amnesty passed by the new Russian parliament. Rutskoy is keeping his promise not to incite civil unrest. He says the Soviet Union should be restored peacefully through a referendum. The UN Secretary General says the Yugoslavian peace conference it is sponsoring with the European Union could be discontinued. Boutros-Ghali says the peace work could be redundant if efforts by the United States and Russia are effective. The UN chief told reporters today the world body would close that channel of peace talks if they're not needed. But he says he doesn't yet see any overlap in peace efforts for the warring republic. He says the UN has no monopoly on making peace. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Larry Sanders Show is often funnier than the TV shows it parodies. Gary Shandling stars as the host of a late-night talk show. My guest Rip Torn plays his producer. Rip Torn also stars in a new independent film set in Vermont called Where the River Flows North. Rip Torn's previous movies include Cross Creek, Heartland, Songwriter, One Trick Pony, Payday, King of Kings, The Cincinnati Kid, Pork Chop Hill, A Face in the Crowd, and Baby Doll. Rip Torn told me that when he got the part on The Larry Sanders Show, he based his character Artie on Johnny Carson's longtime producer, Fred DeCordova.
I based it on the kind of brilliant quickness that Fred DeCordova has, the kind of hands-on operation that he had, that he's there, that he was totally loyal to Mr. Carson, and since a great producer has to be almost like a military commander, he has to be have a touch of savagery, hopefully with good heart behind it.
How has the Gary Sanders Show changed your career, if at all? I mean, being a regular on a TV series, especially something that's developed such a loyal following, it's a different kind of situation than having movies. It's a recurring character. More people see TV, probably.
It's a steady work.
It's steady work, that too. Right. So you're liking it?
I love it.
Good.
Let me say more. We really have a very good. I was talking to John Ziffrin, who's the producer of the Shandling Show, and my mother Thelma Torn from Texas, and my sister Pat Alexander. My mother died between Christmas and New Year, as my sister said, ever considerate, and she was a very beautiful, funny, witty person. And I took her on the show, and Gary Shandling talked to my sister and my mother, and kind of mouth a bit agape. And then later he came over and he said, your mother, Thelma, is so beautiful and gracious, and your sister, Pat, such a gorgeous woman, and they're so sophisticated, they're so witty. And I said, yes. What did you expect? He looked at me and everybody laughed. He said, I guess I expected a redneck mother and a redneck sister. And I says, no, Gary, I'm the only redneck in our family. I'm just trying to explain that when I talked to John about thanking him for the way that my mother was treated, he said, you know, we are a family. And I know that sounds corny, but we have a great time on the Shandling Show. No matter how tired we are, we get bummed out by things, we sit down and have wonderful writers, and we continue to work on the scripts, to even after we're making, say, that's a final take, and Gary or somebody will have an idea and say, let's try this one more thing. And then, so it's very zestful atmosphere.
Let me ask you the question that I'm sure you've been asked more than any other question in your life, and that is the story of how you went from Elmore Torn to Rip Torn.
Well, it's just very simple. It's like baseball players that were named Woods or called Piney, or it's just a nickname.
When did you get it?
I think when I was born, my dad said that the doctor says, since my father's name was Rip, I guess maybe the guy raised dogs or something. He says, Little Rip out of Big Rip.
So your father was nicknamed Rip, or was that his birth name?
His first name, like me, was Elmore, and we had different middle names. But I was nicknamed Rip, and I've got an Uncle Roland down in Houston, Texas, and he's the senior Rip in the family now, and I have a cousin Sam, and he's called Rip, too. It's just because it's the last name. It's Torn. All Torns were called Rip, the male members, anyway.
Right. Now, I read that when you first started off in television that some of the programs insisted that you change your name from Rip Torn back to Elmore or to anything.
No, they didn't want Elmore. They said Elmore sounds like a hick, and Rip sounds like a comedian.
So when you were getting started in television, some programs didn't want you to use the name Rip Torn because they thought it sounded like you were a comic and not a serious actor?
Yeah, sure.
What did you think of that?
I never really worried about that, you know. I think it was when I was signed with the MCA before they became Universal. They had a talent agency, and the woman agent I had, Monique James, says, "Hold on to your hat, dear," said, "your new name will be Richard Torn." And I says, "Monique, they'll call me Dickie Torn." So, what was another name? I think for a while they wanted me to, I was going to be Eric Torn. And then there was, at that time, there were the commercials of the Viking kind of smoking a cigarette. Eric was a cigarette. So I says, "Listen, the first time I played on Broadway, the great director, Elia Kazan, said to me, he says, look, Elmore is corny. Rip sounds like a comedian. I says, we got to change your name. I says, look, there will be no changes. That's me. He said, you could have a great career, but you'll never have it with this funny name. I says, okay, we'll use Elmore, but be sure you spell it right, say it right. Because I used to meet people in New York and say, my name is Elmore Torr, and they say, glad to meet you, Elroy. I says, no, not Elwood, no, Elmore. But I knew a wonderful journalist, Oriana Fallaci, and she said, well, if you had an Italian pronunciation, you'd be Elmore, so that'd be okay.
Now, you grew up in Texas. You originally went to college as an agriculture major.
Yeah.
What did your family say when you switched from what was basically the family tradition, agriculture, ranching, from that to acting?
Well, they didn't like it. And my dad, who was a very remarkable man, Elmore Torn, he set me down on the back porch. I'd gotten out of the Army. I was more mature than a lot of people are when they just start into the profession of acting. And he said, there's been a lot of discussion and raised voices. We have not been able to shake you from wanting to do this. He said, and we've seen you on the stage and you have a rapport with the audience. He said, but if you don't go up to New York City right now and make this attempt to be an actor, he said, whether or not you succeed or you don't, he said, it's something that will trouble you the rest of your life. He said, it's better for you to go up there and make a good attempt, and then you'll be satisfied. And he said, and if you do it 100%, and I'm backing you. Not with money, but with the father's approval.
Good advice?
Well, it was biblical, and I tell this story. But my mom came in to show you my laugh. She said, started crying. She said, oh, son, just promise me one thing. If you go to New York to be an actor, don't wind up in the gutter. And I said, Mom, that's where you start in showbiz.
Were they proud of you?
Oh, yeah.
When your father encouraged you to go, were you surprised that he was giving you that advice?
I was stunned. It didn't produce in me an emotional reaction like it does when I tell that story. What it produced in me was a great feeling of exhilaration and strength. And I felt that I would be successful.
Because you had his backing.
Yeah.
Actor Rip Torn is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rip Torn. Let me get back to the Gary Shandling Show. Do you do a lot of improv within the Gary Shandling Show? Or the Larry Sanders Show, I should say.
Yeah, that's the way I got the job. I met Gary, and then he wanted me to come down. I was doing a movie in Vancouver, and I flew down to see him. And my agents said, you're not to read under any circumstances.
Well, why not?
Well, a lot of times, I don't know what that is. Maybe they think it's something that lowers your bargaining power or something like that. They can then say the reading was because you've got a body of work behind you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done the wonderful role in Defending Your Life, where I played Bob Diamond and a very, very funny character that Albert Brooks wrote and directed.
So your agent figured if they want you, they should just hire you and not make you do an audition.
Yeah, so I went in there, and Gary said, do you want to read? And I says, no. And I saw a look on his face, and I says, but I will. And we started reading through the scripts, and then we spent over an hour, between an hour and 2 hours, maybe an hour and 40 minutes, something like that. And kicking it back and forth. He'd throw me things, and I'd come up with stuff. And he said, you really know this guy, don't you? And I walked out of there thinking I had the part, and then I didn't hear from him for 4 months. And I heard from him the Thursday before the weekend, before I was supposed to start working on. And by that time, I thought, gee, I wonder who got that part in Shandling Show. And John said, hey, he says, you know, from that moment that time you spent in that office improvising with Gary, he knew you were the guy for the job.
It's funny, now your agent said to you, don't read for the part, but you did it anyways. Do you feel bad or like you're committing some terrible error if you break your agent's advice?
No, I'm the main man in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't work for my agent. Actually, right. People think of it that way, but actually you sign a contract with them, but they're, even though it is in actuality a lot of times the other way around, but they are really supposed to be working for you.
So you trust yourself on these things?
Well, even with my errors, it's better to be right or wrong on your own terms, I guess.
Mm-hmm. When there's a guest star on the show playing themselves, doing a guest shot on the Larry Sanders Show,
yeah,
are they always willing to have fun with themselves? In other words, are they always willing to be the butt of a joke or to make fun of their popular image? Or do you sometimes have to encourage people to just relax?
Well, no. Sure. I mean, they come to me. A lot of times they say, I'm completely terrified. Is it always like this? What's going on? What's going to happen? I said, I don't know. But, you know, that's part of the fun of it. You know? That's what I liked about live television, you know. So, but we have a script, and they usually have a wonderful time, and everybody wants to do the show. I mean, with Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, Burt Reynolds, Roseanne and Tom Arnold, and we don't always do everything. The writers, they wanted Tom and me to have a fight on I says, I don't want to do this to you. He says, hell no.
Why didn't you want to do it?
Well, it wasn't... He was trying to get on the show, and I was trying to keep him from getting on the show, which is an unrealistic premise for the character of Artie. Of course he'd like to have Tom come on the show. Why would he want to keep Tom Arnold out of a discussion that Rosie was having with... you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, it
didn't make sense to the character. So, in fact, I was urging him. I turned it and said, I would urge him on. You want to get on there? Get on there. Come on. Let's go, you know.
I get the impression that you're really happy and really relieved, in a way, to have a recurring role on a great series.
Oh, absolutely.
You had a lot of rough spots in your career.
Well, yeah, sure. I used to call it in my non-career. It's helped me to, everybody that has a house here in the East has had some damage from all this severe winter. So I'm able to patch the walls of the house, thank God. And there was one job a guy was doing, and I said, I know what it is. And I said, that's a tough job. And I says, a lot of dust with this one. And I says, thank God I don't have to do it. So I'm glad to have the job and maybe spread it around.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Rip Torn co-stars on the HBO series The Larry Sanders Show, and he stars in the new film Where the Rivers Flow North. This is Fresh Air. The Prime Minister of Israel was at the White House today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing from Ted Clark about the appearance by the Israeli Prime Minister and President Clinton. The two of them called on Syrian President Hafez Assad to resume peace talks with Israel. Prime Minister Rabin asked about settlements in the West Bank, restated the principles of the Declaration of Principles he signed with Yasser Arafat at the White House last fall, saying that Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza remain a final status issue. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing from Mike Schuster, who visited the Crimea, it's the peninsula nowadays in Ukraine, where many Russians live and feel they should not be part of Ukraine.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rossini's William Tell Overture is one of the most familiar pieces in all of music, but the passage we're hearing is not exactly the way Rossini wrote it. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz explains what makes it different.
When Rossini wrote the William Tell Overture, he used a full orchestra, but in the excerpt we just heard, the instruments are only winds. Stephen Richman and his excellent Harmonie Ensemble New York devote their new album to transcriptions of opera overtures for wind band, transcriptions all made at the time the music was first written. Since there were no recordings at the time of Beethoven and Rossini, and not everyone could afford to attend a performance or lived in a city with a concert hall, one way music got to be known was through transcriptions. Orchestral music might be reduced to one or two pianos so people could play symphonies for themselves at home. A complete opera might be performed in transcription even before the opera opened. Many of these transcriptions were made for a small wind band called a harmonie. It usually consisted of pairs of oboes, clarinets, bassoons, and horns, with either a string bass or contrabassoon. aristocrats who could not afford a full orchestra might subsidize their own harmonies. Here's Mozart's own transcription of the overture to his opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio. It sounds like one of his elegant minor key wind serenades. Some transcribers got to be quite successful. Besides Mozart himself, this album includes the work of Wenzel Sedlak and Karl Flachs. It's fascinating to see how clever these 18th and 19th century arrangers were at creating the impression of a full orchestral sound, even strings, through their use of wind instruments. And when they're played as well as they are here, the humor, the romance, and the solemnity of the originals are still present. But what makes these transcriptions most worth listening to is the charm of their own sonorities. The smaller number of instruments allows a freer play of wit. So even grand, ambitious works like the overtures to Rossini's Semiramide or Beethoven's Fidelio, though reduced in scope, have an appealing intimacy. They remind us how thoroughly what we now call concert music was once a part of everyday life.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix and author of the collection of poems Goodnight, Gracie. He reviewed Overture, featuring the Harmony Ensemble of New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.